Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Joey Galvez. I want to tell you guys a little bit about the Department of MetaHuman Affairs. This one is a story about a team led by a retired sidekick, two felons, a failed actor from Broadway, and a reprogrammed cyborg. But their first mission is to stop the criminals who have robbed a bank, and they will have to set the world at ease. You're going to get 180 pages of entertainment, action-packed awesomeness right here in the first six issues in a collected hardcover volume one. All you got to do is head on over to Kickstarter.com and type in the Department of MetaHuman Affairs or DMA and check it out right now.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot, holes, a gratuitous movie. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy.
Dana Gould has been a stand-up comedian for over 30 years. He's also an acclaimed actor, starring in such Hollywood blockbusters as My Fellow Americans and Mystery Men. He's also worked in television, including Seinfeld. Also wrote for The Simpsons for several years. Now he has an incredible podcast, The Dana Gould Hour, and is also the creator of Stand Against Evil, currently airing on IFC. Dana Gould was kind enough to join us on Everything I Learned from Movies.
Thank you so much for doing this with us.
My pleasure. I'm not sure, Candace, so I'd have to go to a dumb dentist appointment.
Oh, no. Can you see us, or do I have that turned off for some reason?
I can't see you, but I see myself.
All right, here we go. Turn on video. Hey! All right, that kind of works.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how about you? Excellent. Well, first and foremost, huge fans. We're going to be seeing you Thursday night.
This is my office. There you go.
Well, this is our office. I guess first and foremost, thank you again. I guess if you start just letting us know, where you grew up and what your family life was like.
I grew up in the middle of Massachusetts, but when people talk about Massachusetts, they think of like Boston or Cambridge, but where I grew up, you'd think upstate New York. Although it's in Massachusetts, I was 50 minutes outside of Boston, and you could be anywhere in the sort of rural East Coast. It's a lot of, it's definitely New England, but it's gun racks and a lot of camo. And I definitely grew up. It's funny, I'm very good friends with Bob Goldthwait and Tom Kenny, and they're from Syracuse, New York. It's basically the same thing. I kind of grew up, I grew up in the sticks, and then I went to college at UMass Amherst, which is also in the sticks. But by that time, I started doing stand-up when I was 17, so I had started to that kind of pulled me out of that hole. Yeah. I hate to think of what my life would have been if I didn't have like a driving force to get the hell out of there.
Nice. And so at like 17, that's when you like moved to Boston and started doing the clubs and stuff there.
Yeah, I started to go into Boston to do open mics. I was going to college. I went to college, but I started doing open mics, so I was going into Boston and broadening my horizons outside of my teeny tiny small town.
Yeah, very nice. And how long were you there for? Like a decade, or I don't know, quite so long.
Quickly, I started doing stand up when I was in 19, when I was 17, and then by the time I was out of college, I got out of college in 86, and I moved to San Francisco in the very end of 87.
Oh, okay, excellent.
I pretty much done Boston. I pretty much had that down. And I didn't want to. I knew I wanted to live in Los Angeles, but I knew I wasn't ready to live in Los Angeles. But I knew I wanted to live in Los Angeles, not New York. Yeah. I thought, well, San Francisco would be a great place to kind of establish myself, get some stage time, and develop, which I knew I still had to do. I knew I wasn't ready, but also develop a network so I could go on the road and make a living as a comedian. So I wouldn't have to go to LA and be a waiter or something. And I have to say, it worked. It's one of the few plans I've had in life that actually worked.
Excellent. Well, so when you came over, I know that was around the same time, like a lot of Boston comedians like Dennis Leary and like those guys were kind of coming over too. Did you just kind of come over as a group, or like they go to L.A. and you went to San Francisco?
Yeah, we all came up together. Dennis moved to New York, and I moved to L.A. But we were all on the same hockey team. Hockey team. Yeah, we all came up together. Stephen Wright and Bobcat were definitely, I mean, they were stars when I was an open micer. But that was the sort of the stew. That was the ingredients in the comedy stew at the time.
Very nice. Well, yeah, so you're in San Francisco, you're doing more open mics and stuff like that, or like established shows?
No, I was working as a feed. By the time I moved to San Francisco, I was working as a feature.
Okay, excellent.
I moved up really quickly. I don't, you know, when I was young, I progressed very rapidly up the ranks. And I was already featuring by the time I moved to San Francisco. And there was a time, you know, when I didn't work much. I was working on the road, and I would do spots at the Holy City Zoo. I was never really, at the time that I was coming up, it was the Other Cafe, the Holy City Zoo, the Punchline, and Cobb's.
Yeah.
And
a lot of those still here.
Some of them.
Yeah.
The Other Cafe, I was never, that was the one, like, team, I never really worked there that much. But the Punchline and Cobb's I worked at a lot. Tom Sawyer, who ran Cobb's, is a big, big, big supporter of mine. I'm really grateful to him. He really gave me a lot of stage time, and I did a lot of developing on that stage as a performer. And but, you know, there was a time when Cobb's was closed. And when it moved from Union, was it Union Street? It used to be on Union Street, and then it moved to the Cannery.
Yeah, I think it's on Columbus and like Union now, where they...
Yeah, it moved from the Cannery to the old Wolfgang's.
Okay.
Right now it's in the old Wolfgang's. Before that it was down in the Cannery, and before the Cannery it was down on Chestnut.
Okay, yeah.
And in between that time, there was really very few places for me to work in town. So I would just do spots at the Holy City Zoo and go on the road a lot. I was on the road a lot in the late 80s.
Nice. And then when you started getting...
Not nice.
Well, and then you started getting into TV and stuff, like, I guess, was the Ben Stiller show your first taste of it?
I moved to LA in 1989, 90. And then, you know, a lot of those things, it's just, those were my friends at the time. Like, yeah. I was friends with Jeannie Garofalo, I knew from Boston, and she, you know, used to come out to San Francisco and sleep on my couch, and then I moved to LA, and she moved to LA, and through Janine I met Ben, and then through Ben I met Bob Odenkirk, and I knew David Cross from Boston, and it's really just the people, it's your social group that, you know, and you just happen to be doing the same thing at the same time, but it's not like it wasn't a planned career thing, it was just, you know, the people that were on the show were the people at the party at the time somebody came up with the idea for the show.
Yeah, I love listening to your podcast, and it's just like, Dana Gould really does know every comedian in the world. It's quite amazing.
Because I started off so young, there's a Forrest Gumpy quality to my career.
And then, of course, like, you know, with, I know you have a fascination with, like, horror movies and all that, too, so it's like all the directors, all the actors and stuff.
Yeah, well, I was super, super lucky because, you know, I moved to L.A. I was still relatively young when I moved to Los Angeles. I was 1990, so I was 25. And I was already working, and I, you know, I love that stuff, so I sought those people out. So, you know, I've been here for 25 years. It would be weird if I didn't know them.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Means it definitely wouldn't be as successful, yeah.
And it's a really interesting, I saw the new Guillermo del Toro movie last night, The Shape of Water.
Oh, yeah, how is it?
Which is basically just a very sexualized remake of The Incredible Mr. Limpet.
It kind of looked that way, so I understand.
It's the creature from the Grabby Lagoon.
Sweetie, they stole my screenplay.
Oh, no! We have this
a
bit
pre-shot interview with him at the Arclight Theater that they ran after, and he said a really interesting thing that I didn't realize that I was doing, but he said, don't make the movies you need to make. Make the movies that need you to make them.
Mm.
You know, and that's, and I didn't realize that that was true, but basically the big successes that I've had follow that. Like Stand Against Evil is a great example of a show that needed me to make it because nobody else was going to make it.
Say we hadn't had TV for a while, so we've been kind of binging over the past couple of weeks. I can't believe I haven't missed it. It is fantastic. It's my wife keeps telling me it's like if I were in a horror movie, how I would react. as Stan.
That's the whole point of the show. That's why the show is funny. It's because people don't behave in a stylized horror movie way. They're in a horror movie, but they behave like regular people. That's exactly the algorithm of the show. And the example that, you know, where I stole that idea was An American Werewolf in London, which is only funny because they're behaving normally. They're not behaving comedically at all. They're not trying to be funny, but they're just behaving like normal people in the ludicrousness of that situation. That's why that movie's funny. Here's a sentence you don't hear a lot. The biggest laugh in Apocalypse Now is when they're in the day-long bridge scene and he goes to one of the soldiers, who's in charge here? And the guy goes, ain't you? And it's just like a really funny, real moment. You know, in war movies, you never hear like, who's in charge here? Rusty. You never hear people going, I don't fucking know.
I assume the guy in front of the line.
Yeah, following this guy. Yeah, and that's really the trick. Is just you just do what the way people behave normally. The whole premise of the show was my brothers and I used to talk about my father. We used to have this joke that if he was in one of the planes shooting at King Kong, that he would fly out of formation and like check the baseball game score. Take a couple shots and then check the score and come back. Like, it's not that he doesn't believe in them; he just doesn't care. Just pretty accurate description.
It's like I'm up in the air. What more do you want?
Come on, Jesus! Yeah, I don't care. It's a vampire loose. It's the All-Star Game.
It's the bottom of the eighth. Come on.
It's pretty much it. Can it wait?
Nice. So
I had to wait for a hockey game to go to the emergency room. I had to wait for a hockey game to end to go to the emergency room. I'm not saying the man didn't make mistakes.
I say, was there playoff implications though? That's the
It was the Bruins.
Okay. So with Stand Against Evil, you're the creator, writer, actor, as Kenny.
Kevin. Yeah, I don't direct Kevin. It. I have no patience for directing.
Yeah.
It's directed by a longtime friend and collaborator of mine, a guy named. Well, it's directed by two groups. Justin, Jim, and Jack Bishop are a team, and they directed the first season and half of the second season. And then Rob Cohen, who was a writer on the Ben Stiller show. I've known him that long. He's a director now, and he directed the second half of the second season.
Very nice. And this was like a big passion project of yours for a lot of years, or like.
I wanted to do a horror comedy. And I wrote a show for Comedy Central. And if there's anything, if I have a regret in the business, I tell a very famous story of, in the early 90s, I auditioned for Saturday Night Live. And it was me and two other comedians. And we were flown to Chicago, and we put up in this big fancy hotel, and we performed. And I went on first and just annihilated. And then the other guy did okay, but not great. And then the third guy didn't even try. He just kind of screwed around. And so I got off stage thinking, all right, well, I'm going to get on Saturday Night Live. I better figure this out, sell my apartment. And we were flying back, the three of us in the three-seat row of the airplane. And I was sitting in the middle, looking at them, going, Chris Rock, Adam Sandler, you guys will get your moment. Just sit back and wait. Your turn will come, and people say like that, but that's not my big regret in my career that I didn't get the show that year. I wrote a show for Comedy Central several years ago called The Last Larry that was basically Shaun of the Dead before that movie came out. It was the cast of Seinfeld in the world of Dawn of the Dead. Yeah. And the reason I said Dawn of the Dead and not The Walking Dead was because it was before The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
We would have gotten in there first. And the regime at Comedy Central at the time didn't think that you could do comedy and horror together. And they were wrong. And it drives me crazy that show didn't go. That's a much bigger regret that I have. And so what Stand Against Evil was my attempt to do it again. Like, I couldn't. By that time, Zombieland had come out and Shaun of the Dead had come out and The Walking Dead was ubiquitous. So it was just like, well, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to do that. What's another way to do it? And basically, I just came up. I remember the thing about my dad. And I basically just thought, like, well, what if Gillian Anderson was partnered with my dad instead of David Duchovny?
Yeah.
And then the show grew from there. I mean, it was pretty simple. And I was going to do it originally as a digital short, like a 7-minute digital thing. And I was going to play my dad in makeup. I'm going to Instagram the makeup test soon. I found it.
Nice.
And then when I ended up selling it to IFC, they was like, well, now we have to get a real actor. Yeah, they were right. I didn't argue. Yes, you do. Yeah,
so, with Janet Varney and, of course, John C. McGinley, is he as cool in person as he seems in the movies?
They're both great. I'm really lucky. I mean, if one of them was an asshole, I'd be really screwed. No, I wrote Evie Barrett for Janet Varney. Yeah. I wrote it. Janet's a really good friend of mine. We've been very close friends for a long time. And I couldn't imagine anybody else playing that role because she's a woman and she's gorgeous, but she's also got a Harrison Ford quality. Like, she can kill you.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a real, just this big, she looks like an eagle and an apple pie and a baby.
That's amazing.
It's an amazing dessert.
So I wrote Evie for Janet, and then I didn't know who was going to play Stan. And I auditioned a lot of people. And went out to a lot of people, and John read it and liked it, and we signed him. But when we signed him, I did not know what he was going to do with it. You know, he was not somebody that I auditioned. He agreed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met with him after he had the role. And I was like, what do you want to do? And it's a very different character than I wrote originally. I wrote him originally when he was older. He was more like my dad. My dad's in his 80s now, but Stan in the show, as I originally wrote him, was in his early 70s. He was a crotchety old guy. And John's much younger and much more athletic. And I think that what he created is so much better than what I had envisioned. And that's the great thing to have as a writer, when you give something to an actor and they bring something extra to it. You know, like, Deborah Baker is another idea, another example. It's funny too. It's because I have four regular cast members, and Janet and Nate Mooney, who plays the deputy, Leon Drinkwater. They are exactly who I envisioned, and I did not know Nate or meet Nate. I just had that guy in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked in the room to the audition with a fake mustache on, and I was like, that's the guy. That's him. And then he read, and he's a genius. He's brilliant. But it was like, Janet and Nate are exactly who I imagined. John and Deborah both took what I wrote and made it something completely unique and much better than I wrote. You know, much more interesting, much more original, and it's just great to let people do what, you know, to step back and let people do what they do is really it's great. On The Simpsons, you know, you're in so much, because it's animated, you know, you're so in control of, you know, you literally tell the animators how you want the character to move and when you want them to, you know, and you know those characters so well that this was really my first experience with kind of letting go and just like, okay, take it, go with it. And it was really, really, really rewarding. It was really, it was great to see. I'm glad that I got to this point. point in my career when I had the personal maturity to allow that to happen.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Yeah, see, because, you know...
Rich's words.
Well, and there's always, like, the warning stories, like, oh, collaboration took your wonderful, amazing idea and kind of, like, mellowed it out, so...
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that if you, you know, when you let people do their job, they're also more open to you going, I love that, but maybe not that.
Yeah.
And it becomes a collaboration. A lot of people's view of a great collaboration is I tell you what to do, and then you do it. We're collaborating.
It's collaborating. It's like compromise.
That's not a collaboration. Yeah. It's the same with, you know, like, does it work that way in personal relationships? Why would it work that way on set? And you can see that in movies and shows that have really, really, really dictatorial direction. They're flat.
Yeah.
You can see it. They're just kind of flat because the director just sits on everything to fit it into their view of what they want. And you don't see people, they don't let people pop because that's not how they imagine it.
Nice. Well, you, of course, mentioned The Simpsons.
I could name names, but... Yes.
Michael Bay. No, I'm
kidding. George Lucas.
Lisa Judger.
No.
Yeah, but I mean, look at what a brilliant... Look at what a great actor Ewan McGregor is.
Yeah.
Look what a great actor Liam Neeson is.
Yeah.
Great. What a great actress Natalie Portman is.
Yeah,
and you see them in those movies, and they're like brown shoes. You know, because they're just, they're in a vice. You know?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of movies even with Hayden Christensen, and I was so convinced he was the worst actor ever, and I'm like, oh, he can actually do some things.
He's a good actor. He's just, they have to let you be a good actor.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but now they have...
And the reverse is true. A good director can make a bad actor look great.
Nice. Yeah,
you can cut somebody. You can cut a great performance out of somebody if you know the right pieces to get.
Excellent. Well, you know, sure. Disney's in control now, so yeah.
I bet directors make me look good.
So we blame them,
Make me look good. I blame myself.
Nice. So you already have your tickets for Last Jedi when it comes out next week, or?
No, I don't. Here's what I hope. I know this is a long shot. But I hope it ends with a giant space battle the rebels aren't supposed to win, but do, while cross-cutting to a sword fight. I just hope that's how it ends. I know that's unlikely.
You know, that's cool, but there needs to be a giant, like, planetary explosion somewhere in there, too.
Yeah. There's got to be some sort of improbable weapon. And, I was not to, like, super nerd out, but, like, I thought the idea of Rogue One was such a great idea. Like, to basically do a spy movie in the Star Wars universe, and then they just turned it into Star Wars at the end. It was really disappointing because I loved that idea of just a spy movie in Star Wars. Do The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, or Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but set it in that universe. And they're like, nah, what if we didn't do that at all?
Yes, well, you know, Episode 9, it may be like an ode to, like, Dinner with Andre or something like that, and it's...
I predict this, I mean, maybe it's just, you know, I have kids that are that age. They're not excited about it. I don't know if there's going to be a fatigue. It might set in.
Yeah, it might, but there's always fans. I mean,
the way to bring it all back is the rebels win the fight they're not supposed to win, but their ship is injured. They crash land on a planet, and they're rescued by these super smart apes.
Then I'll go. Yeah.
Caesar, Last Jedi. I love it.
Planet of the Jedis.
Mean the whole time.
You blew it up. The Death Star. You blew it up again.
Blow up Dan Tweedy. Just cut to Charlton Heston. You blew it up.
Nice. Well,
I have to tell Mel Brooks something.
There's an idea here.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned you worked on The Simpsons. Was it 5 or 6 years you were a writer with them?
Yeah, 6 or 7.
6 or 7? Okay, excellent. And how was that experience? Like, it was already...
I learned how to be a writer there. You know, I learned how to be a funny person. I went from being a funny person to a writer.
Excellent.
And the first thing that I learned there, because I was kind of known when I started working there. I had specials and I was an actor. I'd been on Seinfeld and, you know, I was like a known quantity. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to allow your ego to be obliterated because no one there cares.
Yeah.
Nobody cares. As it should be.
Yeah.
As it should be. And that was the first thing I learned, was just sort of set my ego aside and really serve the script. And I really learned a lot. And I'm really grateful for my time there. I'm glad. I'm also glad I didn't stay. I have more money, but I like that I get to do different things and to take those skills that I learned and apply them to different ideas. I'm, you know, developing. Right now, I'm writing a graphic novel. I'm adapting Rod Serling's first draft of Planet of the Apes as a graphic novel for Boom Comics. And it's the first draft is based on the Pierre Boulle book where they live in a city. And it's a much different movie than what you originally saw. It's very much a political thriller. It has a lot more in common with 7 Days in May or The Manchurian Candidate than Planet of the Apes. It's a very quiet movie. It's not a very big action movie, and it takes place in a city, and there are helicopters and all sorts of things. It's a very different movie, and I'm adapting that for Boom Comics. It'll be a graphic novel that comes out probably spring or late winter. Finally finished.
For my birthday.
Yeah, just in time for her birthday.
Yeah. What was that?
I said just in time for my birthday.
Well, we'll try. We'll try. But yeah, it's really interesting. I get to read his early drafts, and every day I get up and spend 3 hours wondering what words of Rod Serling I'm going to cut. That's not too daunting.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
My brain's out every day. So I'm very lucky in that I have like these two careers that I can do stand up. Which I do stand up because I love doing it, and it's not a hobby, because a hobby implies you don't take it seriously. I take it very, very seriously.
Yeah.
But it's just something that I do for the love of it. I make my living and support my family as a writer. So I'm very lucky that I get to do both, you know, and I don't have to go out to I can still be a stand-up comedian, but I can see my kids grow up because I'm not gone 300 days a year.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, about how many, you mentioned you're on tour and stuff, like, about how many, like, road dates do you have a year?
I go out a week, and then I'm home for two, and then I go out a week, and then I'm home for two or three, and that way it doesn't get stale, it always stays exciting, and and then I can have a real life.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm sure it's hard work and all that with writing and constantly coming up new material and everything, but it sounds like a dream.
Goddamn minute. And then I have kids, and my girlfriend has kids, and it's just like I have a very busy life.
Very, very Brady Bunch situation. But,
it's a bit of it. Yeah, we're not in the same house yet, but there's 3 and 3, so you do the math.
You just got to get a housekeeper, and I smell a sitcom.
Having free time, and that's a terrible combination. I'm not somebody you want to just fill in up a day.
The idle hands doing devil's work, I see.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right, yeah.
So I actually have a question. So I am also a huge movie nerd, and that's actually how I got into your podcast, and then I got my lovely husband into your comedy and podcast.
Oh, good.
That's
true. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And actually, thanks to your lovely podcast.
I have to do this week. Finish that for December.
Yes, yay! Please. thanks to your podcast, I learned a term I had never heard of, the Monster Kids, and it's like, oh, that's exactly what I am. I've always loved monster movies. Growing up, Big Trouble in Little China and Tremors were like my favorite movies of all time. Because I'm a classy girl. So I have a question. On your podcast, I keep hearing you say over and over again, Carnival of Souls is such a magnificent film. And I own a copy of it. And I don't know if it's maybe the edit I have or whatever, but what am I missing? I've been to Solitaire.
That's a great part. I love it, but it's a. I think the thing you have to appreciate with it, and I don't know what cut you have. If you look at the Criterion one, that's like the best one.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that it does that you think you've seen before or that feels familiar, it did first. It was before Night of the Living Dead. It was before all that, all those other things. And it's also very much it's like a French surrealist film at the end. It really goes off the rails and becomes like this crazy dream sequence. So I would put it in the same school with like Eraserhead. It's not like a popcorn movie. There's a homework quality to it, but what I I love just the story that it's the only narrative film he ever made, and it sort of set the template for an entire genre of movies that followed like 10 years later. It was really ahead of its time, and it was it was made in 62. It was really ahead of its time, and it was really an important movie. So,
It's like the Citizen Kane of horror movies. It's done for the industry.
Yeah, in that regard, it's like you have to kind of, we're like Carl Perkins. It's like you might not want to listen to Carl Perkins, but if you like the Beatles, you have to love Carl Perkins.
Yes.
Every guitar fill is him. So it's that sort of thing. It's more of an important movie, and I really loved it, but I got into it, like at the height of David Lynch mania. Did you guys watch The Return?
Oh, Twin Peaks?
I know you weren't too deep.
We watched the first couple seasons a couple times. We haven't seen the new one yet, but we hear mixed reviews. Yeah.
We
actually did an episode of our podcast on Fire Walk With Me, and the interesting experience that was.
I remember seeing that the night it came out, and I walked out of it going, what did I ever do to you?
To prepare for it, we made the mistake of watching Blue Velvet, and...
much better film. I actually really love Blue Velvet. I think Blue Velvet's hilarious.
It's very unique.
But Blue Velvet, to me, is really funny. Like, Blue Velvet is like the first season of Twin Peaks. Like, it knows what it's doing, and it has a center of gravity to it. Mm-hmm. And then it just goes crazy.
Nice. Well, one of the first things I just actually realized just listening to your podcast, you were the voice on the Gex video game. And as soon as you mentioned it, I was like...
I cannot escape it.
As soon as you had mentioned it on the podcast, I was like, lock and load, little lizard. Yeah, that's him.
Written with Rob Cohen from the Ben Stiller Show.
And now Stand Against Evil, too, yeah.
And now Stand Against Evil, yeah. He's, that's funny. That game is beloved by people.
It is.
When I go on the road, inevitably I will get, somebody will bring a cartridge to sign.
Oh, nice. Don't have to worry about bringing mine. I apparently lost mine over the years.
Well, now people think he's coming back because he looks so much like the Geico.
Well, that was the kind of thing, too. It was like when those commercials came out, I was like, oh, they're bringing Gex back. Now he's CGI. Yeah,
exactly.
I got it.
Oh, Gex is CG now. Nice.
What's up with his accent? That's not Danny Gould.
So we're back to Stand Against Evil.
Yeah.
I have to ask, what was it like working with Daffodil the Pony?
She was a delight. it was funny. We had Daffodil, and then we had a real horse in it. And at the beginning of that episode, there was a real horse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the week that my kids were visiting the set because we shoot it in Atlanta. So there was a lot of horses around, and I'm not a horse dude. I've ridden them, but I don't enjoy it. I described riding a motorcycle as being dragged through the woods on a motorcycle that hates you. But the pony was really cool. The big horse. We shot near these railroad. We didn't know it at the time, but one of our locations is the busiest railway intersection in America. It's like for 20 seconds. Little 20-second bursts in between the train going by, and the the big horse was standing there, and the train came by and blew its whistle.
Oh.
And I now know the origin of the phrase "scared shitless."
So wait, how often does a train go by? So like often you don't even notice.
Twice a minute. But it was just, I was standing there, so it was just, and just okay, he's ready.
Yes, yeah, that episode specifically is very American Werewolf in London, like with the
that was a great job by Jack and Justin, and our music composer Evan Schletter. All of that stuff was very much an homage to Werewolf.
Excellent. Yeah, Evan Schletter, amazing artist. You hear him on the Spontaneous Nation with Paul F. Tompkins as well. It's amazing.
Yeah, and he goes back to Mr. He's, again, you know, how did you get Evan Schletter? He's my friend who's a musician.
He crashed on my couch for 3 months.
Well, it's just like he was on Mr. Show, which came from, you know, Mr. Show was just the people on Ben Stiller that weren't doing anything at the time. It's the same group of people, and fortunately, they're all really brilliant.
Yeah.
Evan is crazy, crazy brilliant.
Yeah, and it's always amazing to hear, like, oh yeah, we were like roommates off and off here. Like, oh yeah, you know, Zach Galifianakis came in for a couple months and then went out, and just
It's just that's. I think it's the same with music. It's just like, well, how did he get the band? He was around.
Yeah. That's pretty.
You
cool.
find that it's the same thing. You know, all those the original like. The 70s filmmakers like Coppola, Spielberg, Lucas, Brian De Palma, all those guys, they were just friends.
Yeah,
you know, they were all in each other's houses. That's how they all came up together. Just, I think that's like that with any. I think it was like that with the Silicon Valley. It was just like those are the guys that were hanging out at that time.
Unless you're my dad and you punch one of them in the face and get kicked out of the computer club.
Oh, no.
That's a true story.
Who did he punch?
Oh, he punched Steve Jobs before he was Steve Jobs.
That's fantastic.
That's so. That's right, Thomas Fisher, current owner of MSI Computers. You've never heard of them for a reason.
Yeah, I bet he's quietly happy.
Oh, he's not quietly. He's quite proud of himself.
Yeah, I understand.
You talk about your dad, and my dad is the California version.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. I get that totally. That's said.
Nice. All right. So another one of my wife's favorite movies of all time, and mine I like as well. My Fellow Americans.
Oh my God.
What was it like? Yes. Were you expecting Mystery Men? Because that was pretty cool too. But.
I thought you were going to say Planet of the Apes. But yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's so funny you say that. I was at a party Saturday night, a Christmas party. I don't know if you know who Arden Marine is. I was at Arden's house for a Christmas party, and Wayne Fetterman, the comedian, walked up to me and just said, I was just watching a Jack Lemmon movie, and then you were in it.
Yeah, did you get to work with Jack and, of course...
I spent 3 days with Jack Lemmon and James Garner.
Oh, I love James Garner.
Just sitting around. It was the greatest experience ever. And by the third day, you're like, hey, Jack. Hello.
It's insane.
It's insane.
So,
hello, love.
All right, so we're.
Nice sketch, bro.
How was?
Just trying to quit smoking. He was a little crabby. But he was nice. But he was just like.
Yeah, we just love the Rockford Files. So it was like I was like working with James Garner.
He was great. He was really sweet. He was, you know. He was, but he had some really great stories, and you know, he was a real dude. He was a man.
Yeah.
He was a man.
He was.
And he was telling stories about being in Bruce Lee's dojo. Like, yeah, it was me and Jimmy Coburn and RJ, and it was Robert Wagner.
Yeah.
These people are legends.
Yeah, Steve McQueen and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, like all these guys.
Jack Lemmon was talking, telling me, and he said, blah, 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 and Marilyn was there, and you realize he's talking about Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Damn it, it was just Marilyn. And Marilyn was there, and it's crazy.
And who was my co-star? Tony. Tony, yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
But hopefully you, I was really lucky to to get that gig, to be able to. The weird story I have is after we shot it, about 2 weeks later, I was driving my car through L.A. I was in Beverly Hills coming home from something, and I was in traffic, and I just heard a beep. And I looked, and it was Jack Lemmon in his car waving.
Nice. That's
awesome. Insane to me. Like, oh, Jack Lemmon just, all right.
So wait, that's not how it is constantly in L.A.? I just assumed.
No, it's not. I was in Beverly Hills next to Jack Lemmon in traffic. I was in the Mid-Wilshire next to Joe Strummer once.
Yeah.
I was on the Bay Bridge with Neil Young. Those are my celebrity sightings.
Very nice. Oh. I love it. I just assume it's like you're going to Starbucks and it's like, oh, hey, Kevin Bacon, how's it going?
Yeah, you see that a little bit, but yeah, they're not as ubiquitous as you think. You see them in weird places, like you go to Ojai and it's like, the one weirdest thing was on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City, impatiently waiting for Steven Stills to pull out so I could take his parking space.
That's amazing.
You're just like us.
Yeah. Do you love the one you're with at home so I can park here, please?
Yeah. Excellent. And you were also in Father's Day with Robin Williams, Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
How was that experience?
I got that through Robin, who was a friend, and basically, Robin was nice enough to put me in that, and then and I see Billy a lot because his daughter and I are parents at the same school.
Oh,
but his daughter Jennifer and I our kids go to the same school, so I always see Billy at functions. So it's just it's a weird, like, I was just chatting with Billy Crystal the other day at the Crystal pageant.
He was behind me honking because I was taking too long to pick up the kids.
I did not think he would remember me. He totally remembered.
Oh, nice.
He's got a steel drop brain. I hadn't seen him in years, and I introduced myself. I said, hi, Billy. I'm sure you don't remember me. He goes, hey, you're Danny. You're Robin's friend. How are you?
Aww.
I was like, nah.
Yeah. Yeah, some people, like, for me, I'm always like, I know your face from somewhere. I think it starts with a J. But, yeah, most people are like, oh, yeah, you're this person, and I remember this.
He's spooky good at that stuff. Oh yeah, all right. Crazy.
Either that or you're just that memorable.
There you go.
Or I had a TV show. I was wearing my I'm Dana Robbins friend T-shirt.
Oh, oh. Well,
that's a great icebreaker.
So you've got a new special coming out?
I was going to do a special, but I was getting ready to go to Atlanta to shoot the show, second season of Standing at Stephen. There was a production hiccup with the company that was going to make the special, and they had to move it, and they moved production, which would have meant that I would have had to record it like 4 months later because I would not, it was in the middle of production of Standing at Stephen. I couldn't do it then, and then I would have had to wrap, edit, post, go on the road for a month to get the material in shape, and then record the special. And comedy material, it has a shelf life to you, and you can feel it getting old.
Okay.
You know? And or not old, but you can feel it getting ripe is a better way to put it. You can feel it getting ripe. And all of this material, I was like, this stuff is ready to go. And I don't know how good it's gonna be if I take 4 months off and then try to relearn it. And so instead I just recorded it as an album.
Oh, nice.
And I said, let's just get it down and I'll do a special for the next batch of material. And that's what I did. So I recorded it. It's called Mr. Funny Man. It's on Kill Rock Stars. It just came out. And it came out in October. It's doing very well. And the next batch of material I'm working on now will be a special. And that's what I'm working on. So if you guys come out to the Punchline in San Francisco this weekend, you'll see the beginnings of that next special.
Yay!
Excellent. Well, we'll be there Thursday.
I'll be the chick in the Belavacqua heating and air shirt.
Yes, they're back. I finally got John Ennis and I were finally able to connect and go back to doing Two Guys from Boston, which I was very People really love it.
Yeah, the triumphant return.
I thought I that's definitely one of those things where, like, Andy Kindler said something that I always quote, which is, my target audience is men my age who are me. And I always felt that about everything I did. Like, everything I did was so specific. Stand Against Evil is this crazily specific show. The way I do my stand-up is very specific. And there's in a detrimental sense. I have a nice... I'm not performing where Jeff Dunham is performing, you know. Like, mm-hmm. I'll go into town and I'll work at Uncle Lucky's Chuckle Hutch, and Jeff Dunham will be, you know, performing in a dry lake bed. No, largest number of seats before infinity for the new Jeff Dunham show. I tend to be a lot more niche, I guess is the word, and everything I do tends to fit into that weird, like, my comedy is very niche, my TV show is very niche. You just have to do that. You just have to be, it's like you just have to be true to what you do.
Yeah, and you have definitely a very passionate fan base, I assume. I mean, yes, I know for us, definitely. But
I'm very lucky. I'm really happy that people like it. It's like, you know, it's funny. I always draw musical analogies, and it's like I don't like the term girlfriend because she's not a girl, she's a woman, but woman friend, it sounds like somebody you have grandpa brings to Thanksgiving dinner with him in case his machine breaks down.
She's your lady friend because she's classy.
Lady friend, yeah. adult human woman social companion. She really loves Nick Cave. And it's sort of like Nick Cave has his fans. They buy everything he does when it comes out. They really support him. But he's not out selling out Dodger Stadium.
No.
But he always has a... Every time he makes something, you know it's good because you believe in his voice and his fans support it. And I think that's the best way to have a long career. Build your fan base in and serve that.
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do.
As somebody outside your target demographic, I can say I do have all of your podcasts and I've got one of your shirts and your show TiVo'd because you're doing what you love and there are other people out there who love it too.
Oh, yeah, I'm very happy. I'm very lucky. I'm really lucky and I'm really happy about it.
How's the for Halloween you did a couple of the readings of Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah.
How did those shows go? We were really
those were amazing, and you know, there's nothing like Plan 9.
No.
You know, and we're doing it again for Sketchfest. But we're not doing Plan 9. We wanted to do something else because we did Plan 9 last year.
Okay.
So this year we're doing The Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Excellent.
But it's going to be a little different because there's just nothing like Plan 9.
Yeah.
So for this one, it's going to be a hybrid of a reading of The Boy in the Plastic Bubble and some other elements that I'm building into it. You cannot top Plan 9.
Yeah. Just to clarify, that's the John Travolta TV movie version, not the Bubble Boy or whatever. Yeah.
No, this is the original, played straight as a heart attack, Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Well,
and that was in January.
Oh, so excited.
Sketchfest. And we're doing a Stand Against Evil panel.
Yay!
Nice.
Yeah.
And is that down in Los Angeles, or...?
No, this is in San
Francisco. Okay, yeah, that's why I thought. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so in San Francisco.
We're bringing everybody up. Everybody's coming up for the panel, and we're doing The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. And The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, it'll be me, it's Janet, Deborah, Nate. I don't know if John's going to be available. Stephen Ogg, who was the Werepony.
Yeah.
And is on Walking Dead. He's in it. And, it's going to be really... And Scott Adsit, who's a crazy genius from 30 Rock, is in it. It'll be really fun.
Excellent.
Oh, I look forward to that.
Well, if you're ever looking for more movies to do like that... I know one favorite of this podcast and a personal favorite of my dear mother's. It's no Plan 9, but A Boy and His Dog.
Oh, is, the Don Johnson movie.
Yes.
Might be excellent as well.
I'll have to give that a look because we were really trying to find movies to do. We're going to do maybe St. Elmo's Fire.
Ooh.
That might be doing. But we were always looking. I'll have to give that a look. I haven't seen that in decades. I'll have to look at it.
I don't know a better post-apocalyptic film about a boy and his telepathic dog.
Yeah, well, I agree. Did Harlan Ellison write that?
Yes.
I think
yes,
so.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he's not hard to piss off. That's all in play Harlan. Well, guys, thank you very much for having me on. I super appreciate it. And whatever night you come this weekend, please come up and say hello.
Yeah, Thursday Absolutely. Night. We'll see you there. Yeah, thank you for joining us. And as mentioned, the name of our podcast is Everything I Learned from Movies. So in summation, what have you learned from your time in the movie industry and everything in general, I guess?
Well, I have two lessons that I've learned. And one, I'll reiterate that what I learned last night was the one thing that I've learned from the business is that things lead to things. And if you do stuff, it will lead to stuff. And the worst thing you can do is just sit in your apartment and bitch. You need to get out there and do stuff. And, you know, Francis, and the other thing is if you, and so that's what it is, just do stuff, make stuff, go, do stuff. The whole internet there, you can make it and post it. Keep doing it. Things lead to things. And the other one is if you believe in a project, you really want to, you believe it, just start it. And Francis Ford Coppola said, like, if you are at one end of town and you have a bass drum and you walk down the middle of the street banging that drum, by the time you get across town, there will be a parade behind you.
Yeah.
But you just have to keep going. And that's absolutely something that I've found to be true. That's my reminder that I have to go do the
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much. We'll meet up in a couple of months when the new stuff's coming out, and
absolutely. I'll see you in a week.
Oh yeah, well yeah. See you on Thursday.
Look for the insanely tall guy and the chick in the Belle of Aqua shirt.
Okay, great. How tall are you? Just so I know.
Six 6'8".
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll stand out.
You got a full foot on me. thank you guys really so much, and I'll see you Thursday. Great.
Yeah. Thank Excellent. You so Have a good
much.
Day, sir. Thank you so much.
Bye. Have
thank
fun.
You very much. Bye.
Hey, sweetie. Yeah. So we just talked to Dana Gould. My wife is screaming incoherently for some reason, but yeah, it was awesome. When we started this podcast, one of our dream interviews was getting Dana Gould on, so we are glad that he was kind enough to join us.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Seriously, guys, watch Stand Against Evil on IFC. It's amazing.
Can we do a mini episode all about Stand Against Evil?
Sure, why not?
Can we do a whole separate podcast where we talk about every single episode and how amazing they are?
Steve Against Evil. Steve Against Izzy. I like the sound of that podcast.
It's a battle royale.
It's a battle royale that Steve
always
wins.
He has the size, but she takes out his knees every time.
Coming next week. No. But yeah, that was awesome. So yeah, go to danagould.com. Find out where his live shows are going on. Order Mr. Funny Man, his latest. He's also got plenty of other of his comedy albums on there. But yeah, check it out.
If you didn't get my reference about Belle of Aqua Heating and Air and my t-shirt, go buy the t-shirt and then get all kinds of caught up on Dana Gould Hour and you'll understand why Belle of Aqua Heating and Air is fucking awesome.
Dana Gould.
Is that cool if wig? You're cool.
The Dana Gould Hour. Never an hour. yeah, it's a great podcast. Usually about 2 or 3 hours an episode, but it's once a month. So, but it's always
podcast
amazing.
Podcasts reach for the sky on Dana the Dana Gould Hour. We barely try.
So yeah, thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll get more celebrity interviews in the future. It's always amazing just to hear their stories and how they got in the industry and just what they've learned from their years in the industry. I really enjoy it, and hopefully you guys do too. Hit us up on Twitter at EILFmovies. That's Everything I Learned from Movies. We're at EILFM.podbean.com. We're on the tweet. We're on the Facebook.
Soon to be at istalkyoudanagould.com. No, I'm just kidding.
.org. No.
It would be a .org, wouldn't it?
So yeah, until next time, I'm Steve.
And I'm Izzy.
And this is Everything I Learned from movies. Have a good night, everybody.
Oh my god. Oh my god.